Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Get ready for another frank and useful conversation with Thomas Frank, the easy chair columnist from Harper's Magazine. It's been 5 years since Bush's economic meltdown. Has anything changed? That's what we'll chew over with Tom Frank in our exclusive conversation coming up right away. And in our second segment today, climate change activist Ken Jones joins us. He's with 350 Bay Area, and we're going to update you on fracking in California and some weak legislation over in Sacramento addressing the fracking challenges. But first, I always like to thank the people who make this program possible, our subscribers. Let's name Ron Fuller, a brand new annual subscriber from Florida. Thank you, Ron. Also, Abby McMillan just renewed. And I want to thank Christopher Welsh, Gary Washington, and Kevin Kallstein. Kevin, thank you very much. If you're not a subscriber, just go to my website, peterbcollins.com. It's easy. Follow the link that says sign up. Under my picture on the homepage in the upper left corner. And I've still got bags of Kona coffee to give away to new annual subscribers. A handful of copies of the bonus book, Sibel Edmonds Classified Woman. And I have a few more of those Bradley Manning, free Bradley Manning stickers that I can give away if you ask. The other way you can support our program is to steer your business to GoDaddy.com. The best deals on domain name registration and web hosting are right there at GoDaddy with excellent customer service. I know, I use GoDaddy. Right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, it starts at just $1.99 a month, and they'll throw in your domain name free. To get a special deal that supports the Peter B. Collins Show, follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Five years ago, mid-September, we started to experience the financial meltdown right at the very end of the Bush-Cheney administration. And it was Nancy Pelosi who rallied the Democrats to support the bailouts that have empowered the Tea Party and deficit hawk Republican extremists into the present day. Despite that lengthy string of Wall Street prosecutions that Eric Holder claims responsibility for, not so much has changed in the last 5 years. And Thomas Frank, who is the easy chair columnist at Harper's Magazine, and also the author, among others, of Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right, returns to our program today after an unexplained absence. Tom, how are you?
I am great, Peter B. Collins.
It's always fun to talk with you, and thanks for joining me. Let's first describe for the people who cannot see our Skype connection that you're wearing a, what is this, Wichita State t-shirt?
Wichita State University, the Shockers.
Yeah.
It's their mascot. It's a shock of wheat.
Uh-huh.
And it's he's really angry. He's an angry shock of wheat. He's so coming to kick your butt.
We can take the boy out of Kansas, but...
Yeah, I'm afraid you'll never take the Kansas out of me, Peter B. Collins.
Has anybody ever tried to get a book deal around What's the Matter with Thomas Frank?
Well, you know, there's many articles about that, trying to diagnose me. What is my problem, and why won't I shut up?
Well, send me some of those, will you? I'm not familiar with them. They're not on my Facebook page or any of the listservs that I subscribe to.
It's just a quick Googling will acquaint you with all the things wrong with me.
Uh-huh. And how do you feel about your detractors? Are they people that you love and want to hug even closer to you?
Well, I stopped paying attention to them a long time ago, Peter. They when I first started, this is like almost 10 years ago now that What's the Matter with Kansas came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised at first when so many people were so hostile. But I got over it really quickly, and I just stopped caring.
Yeah,
that's the only way to do it. You know, when I started out in journalism, I used to write for the Chicago Reader, and I have a fairly abrasive style on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And
we'll get to your exorcatory metaphors, which I think are a first for Harper's in this month's column. But go ahead.
But
and who was the guy who ran the Reader? Wasn't his name Roth?
I never met him.
Okay.
I worked with a different guy.
All right.
It was my editor.
I think Roth was the founder. I was
right.
Actually there in Chicago in the early 70s when the Reader started.
Oh, yeah. That was their heyday.
Yeah.
They were great. They were one of the very first alternative news weeklies in America.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And
so enough about me. Your edgy.
They were one of the better ones.
Your edgy style in the Reader. Go ahead.
Okay. So when people would write in letters to the editor, very naturally taking exception to what I had said, I would take it personally, and I would insist on replying. This is my first sort of foray into journalism, and it took me a while to figure out never to do that. It's not personal,
So after this column, will we expect to see a letter to the editor of Harper's from, say, Hank Paulson?
I doubt it. I don't think Hank Paulson reads Harper's. He might, though.
Yeah.
But that would be really something if he wrote in. That would
be great. Where is Hank Paulson today? He remains unindicted and at large, along with Angela Mozzillo and many others.
But he was on the side of Law and Order. So I don't know if you could indict him or anything like that. But he wrote a memoir. And I don't know what he's up to these days. But do you remember how scary it was so this is 5 years ago, September of 2008,
mm-hmm.
and Hank Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury, went to George Bush and got a blank check to just do whatever he wanted to fix the situation. And the country was in a state of panic.
Well, and then he wrote that 3-page extortion notice that was delivered to the leadership in Congress. And,
yes, that's right.
And there were no details to it. It was give us $700 billion or the sky is going to fall.
That's right. And you remember how they would call him to testify all the time during these days. And every time Hank Paulson would – the photographers would catch him, he had this – he would have his cell phone clasped to his ear, and he had this expression on his face. It's just sort of the way his face looked that inspired panic. Do you remember that? It looked like a scared rabbit. Now, I don't think he was. I think he had the situation – or he imagined that he had the situation under control. But you compare him to someone like Bernanke, who is completely unflappable. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing would ruffle Bernanke's feathers. But Hank Paulson, it was just, he just it inspired panic.
Well, you thought he might explode at any moment. that kind of Uncle Fester head of his, you know? So the early indications were the crisis at Bear Stearns and then the failure of, do you say Lehman or Lehman Brothers?
I think it's Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, okay.
But they took over the government. I think Hank Paulson took over Fannie and Freddie the week before that. You know, they were on the verge of going down, and they took them over. But we had known that the housing bubble was over. The housing bubble had been discussed a lot. You know, there was debate over whether it really existed, whether there were such things as bubbles. I mean, there were friends of mine were talking about it all the time, going back to like 2003, 2002, that sort of thing. And so that was well known, and it was well known that it had passed its peak and was deflating pretty rapidly. But nobody really had prepared the public for things like the failure of Lehman Brothers. And when that happened, everybody knew that the jig was up. And it was all in that one day. Do you remember that very same day, Merrill Lynch knew that they were finished, and they went running into the arms of Bank of America.
Well, can we rephrase that? Hank Paulson engineered this shotgun wedding and forced Bank of America to take over Merrill.
I forgot the details, whether it was him or Tim Geithner.
Because I'm trying to remember who the CEO of B of A at the time was, but he was...
Thane was the head of Merrill Lynch.
Merrill,
he came up for a lot of mockery later on when it was learned how much he had spent like remodeling his office. Do you remember this? But by Wall Street standards, he was not much of a plutocrat. You know, he only got paid a couple of million a year. You know, he wasn't like these hedge fund guys. You know, taking home a billion, you know, stuff like that. And there were guys that did that back. They're doing it again now. But I didn't remember that Paulson had a role in that. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, AIG was going to go down. And that's when they stepped in and started bailing like crazy. They had refused to bail out Lehman Brothers. They had bailed out Bear Stearns the year before, but they refused to bail out Lehman Brothers. It collapsed. Stock market fell 700 points. Everybody was panicking, and then the next day they reversed themselves, Geithner and Paulson, and started bailing.
Now there's one really critical detail that you left out of the narrative here, and that was that John McCain put his campaign on hold and returned to Washington to do absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I remember that.
I'm suspending this losing campaign because there's a crisis, and maybe I can change the subject.
But you know among other things, this is why he wasn't elected, you know, is because the stock market fell 700 points and continued fall. It was catastrophe. And do you remember one of his big advisors was Phil Graham, the senator from Texas, who would have been Treasury Secretary if McCain had been elected, probably would have been. And he was one of the architects of deregulation and also had made a sort of notorious speech in which he said that Americans were a nation of whiners. Do you remember that?
And good old Wendy Graham was on the board at Enron. He was wrapped up with Kenny Boy. And I still am fond of his printer, though, Dickie Flat.
Yeah, you remember that guy. Yeah. I made him mad. I was writing for the Wall Street Journal at the time. And I made fun of Phil Graham, and I referenced Dickie Flat. That was a long time ago
now. And if we can just clue in our listeners who might be scratching their heads saying, who the fuck was Dickie Flat? Dickie was the printer who Phil took all of his campaign materials to. And he was kind of the folky icon of everyman who Phil Graham would invoke as often as Bob Dornan used to pull out that plastic fetus.
Yeah. But Phil Graham's populist hero was this guy Dickie Flat, and he would refer to him all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyhow,
as he flattened the American economy.
Yeah, that's right.
But allow me a reading here of this paragraph with the execratory metaphor, because it is pretty powerful.
Yeah, you're now talking about this is an article that's in the present issue of Harper's Magazine.
Oh, I forgot the plug. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
It was the unavoidable explosion after decades of deregulation and willful blindness. A kind of waste product had been deliberately moved through the bowels of 100 shady mortgage outfits. It was then gilded by delusional ratings agencies and sold to the world by the most respected names in finance. Bribery and deceit and crazy incentives had been the laxatives that pushed this product down the pipe. Money and bonhomie and reassuring economic theory had been the sedatives that put the regulators to sleep. Now, have you been watching, like, one of the nightly newscasts on network television that just has these parade of commercials for the ills of baby boomers, from restless leg to adult diapers to, wood enhancement?
I was just casting about for a different metaphor. I mean, I've written about this, you know, when I was at the Journal, I wrote about this many times, and I wrote, you know, in Pity the Billionaire, many times more. I was straining at the ends of metaphor. You know, we needed something new, so there you go.
And just one more attempt here.
I mean, why not say it, right?
Now, for you, this column could almost write itself after all the work you did on Pity the Billionaire and your Wall Street Journal columns. Did you actually write this in the can? And is that why this metaphor was so...
You know what suggested it? Do you remember... am I allowed to use the word on your show?
You have no restrictions on your language.
That moment where there was a hearing, a Senate committee was doing a hearing about Goldman Sachs, and they had put together a mortgage-backed security that was designed to fail,
mm-hmm.
and they had referred to it in their internal emails as one shitty deal.
Right?
Do you remember?
Yeah. And Carl Levin, picked up
times.
On that, and he relished the opportunity to keep asking this guy about shitty deals.
Yeah. And that was actually one of the best moments, in my view, one of the best moments in the whole history of our reaction to this disaster. If we'd had more moments like that, if Democrats had had the leadership of the party, not just a senator from Michigan, but the actual, you know, party apparatus had the, you know, courage to just, you know, to rub stuff like that in the nation's face, I think we would have had a very different reaction to this.
And there is, to be fair, no anti-shitty deal clause in Dodd-Frank. And that's the legislation that the banks say constrict them, and they're all constipated, if I can stay with your metaphor here. And they have record profits. They continue to pay out these huge bonuses. They're unapologetic for the bailouts that they took. And they're screwing borrowers on a regular basis.
Yes, but now there's probably a million things that we don't know about that they're doing. This is the thing, Peter B. Collins. When you have a catastrophe like this, and you refuse, for whatever reason, you refuse, you know, we'll go into the reasons later, but you refuse to take the necessary steps to remediate the problem. You know, you don't. In the 1930s, remember that one of the basic things that the Roosevelt administration was elected to do and made it their business to do was to make sure that something like the colossal screw up of 1929 would never happen again, right? And they would regulate Wall Street in all sorts of ways. There were all these shady practices going on in Wall Street, and they made them all illegal, and they cracked down on them, and they put people in jail, and they enforced the law, and they reformed the system in 100 really essential ways. We didn't do that this time around. We didn't even come close to doing that this time around. And what happens when you don't do that? What happens when you don't do that? I mean, you know the answer.
It happens again.
Of course it does. You know, I look out at the world around me. It's happening in exactly the same way. If you just go to Google and enter flipping houses into the searcher, there's this whole industry out there teaching people how to do this again.
Well,
it's all happening again.
And Jeremy Renner was the host on Saturday Night Live rerun last weekend, and somehow in my reading I picked up a tidbit that Jeremy Renner has been flipping houses. And I don't know if he has a get-rich-quick scheme that he's selling the Jeremy Renner house-flipping deal, But it just shows that not only is house flipping back, but celebrities are getting into it. And maybe we'll have a house flipping reality show with Jeremy Renner. Who knows?
Yeah. But given the, you know, another thing that we don't often talk about these days is how our financial media really failed us in the run up to the crisis. They really didn't know what was happening until it was too late. Nobody had any idea that Wall Street had bought mortgage originators and was packaging this stuff up and was basically pushing mortgages on people, you know, the no-doc loans, the liar loans, Alt-A loans, pushing mortgages on people so that they could package them up and sell them off to, you know, hapless, clueless investors in Germany and the Scandinavian countries and places like that. This was all part of a machine, and nobody knew it. Well, the Wall Street banks knew it, but mm-hmm. the public did not know it until it was too late. And so, I mean, given the sort of state of journalism now, of course you and I aren't going to know until it's too late.
Tom, what you just described is really significant. It is that the root cause of this was predatory lending. And yeah. It wasn't just to scam the borrowers. It was part of a bigger scheme that
scammed everybody at both ends.
Right.
They scammed their own shareholders. Everybody got scammed except for the executives who are getting the bonuses.
So we wrote a lot of these high-risk adjustable mortgages for people who qualified for 30-year fixed. We jammed them on them saying that, you get a better interest rate for a little while and you can always refinance because you've always been able to refinance. The mortgage broker who sold them that shitty deal got a big commission, and none of those commissions have ever been disgorged. Then up the chain of command, those were then packaged and, inappropriately labeled AAA when those, packages certainly didn't live up to that representation.
And then, the bond rating agencies got their bonuses. Don't forget that. Yeah. They had their incentives. Everybody had incentives.
Then these securitized mortgage packages, kind of like some Oscar Mayer baloney, were sold to foreign investors, and they couldn't separate the parts of the baloney. And therefore, these investments all went down the tubes. And when you look at that chain of responsibility, and what is astounding 5 years hence, and I don't know where the statute of limitation lies on all this, but virtually no one...
We're coming up to it, by the way.
Virtually no one has been held accountable. We have FAB, right?
Yeah, one guy.
They nailed FAB.
They did, but they're just suing him. You know, he has to pay a settlement or something.
Right. It's a civil case, not a criminal case.
The important thing is criminal cases. That's what matters. And I have no doubt that the Wall Street banks were being very careful, many steps of the way, following the letter of the law. I'm sure they were. But we also know that they were issuing something called liar's loans. We know they were doing that. There's no question about it that they were doing that. And you know that that stinks to high heaven. And it would – I think that a lot of the sort of – I mean it doesn't – like I said earlier, the source of our failure to look into this and our failure to remediate the situation doesn't really matter. But it is kind of interesting. You'd think a guy like Barack Obama, at least when he first came into office, I thought he would be very anxious to look into this. This is actually a funny thing. If you remember back in 2008, John McCain said, we need to hold hearings in the Senate and see what's happened here. And Obama made fun of him and said, look, we know what happened, Mr. McCain. But in retrospect, I think McCain had the right idea. He might have, he really didn't have a clue at the time. Obama had a much better sort of grip on the situation just because, Obama is that kind of guy. But McCain is a sort of old school, maybe he was a law and order guy. Maybe he actually would have done something. We now know that Obama, in his, desire to have red and blue get together and not relitigate the past and not hold anybody responsible, part of that has just been letting this whole thing slide. And that is a terrible mistake. A terrible mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, by his standards, everything worked out, right? He got reelected. And the Republicans nominated this moron, Mitt Romney.
Who was really part of the problem, and Americans did pick up on that. Yeah. But it's interesting to me, again, 5 years hence, that the characterizations of the cause of our financial problems in 2008 are so pro-Wall Street. Example,
yes.
Because my listeners don't have to, I watch the public television news hour every night, and it's got a lot of weaknesses, but it's the best long-form television show that we have. And Judy Woodruff repeatedly will interview banksters and their apologists and describe the fundamental cause of the financial crisis as the borrowers. That,
yeah.
Well, you know, there were a lot of people who took loans that they shouldn't have taken out. As if the whole crux of it was because of these aggressive borrowers, when in fact they were led down a garden path. Most of them didn't want these high risk adjustable loans.
No, of course not. And we all know we all know people who are in a situation where they'd be renting an apartment, and suddenly their landlord would say, "Okay, everybody in the building has to buy their apartment, and here you just step right up to AmeriQuest or whatever, they'll fix you up with the loan," and then this was happening all over the place,
the nomenclature of subprime loans kind of sent a signal right there.
Yeah, well, yes, and no doc loans or stated, they were called stated income loans,
right.
Which means whatever, you get the loan no matter what, and it takes two to tango. It's not just the borrower, and these people were in many situations the lender was. More sophisticated than the borrower, a lot more sophisticated, would actually know more about the borrower's situation than the borrower did. It's a weird sort of inversion of the sort of traditional economic rules, but that's the way it was. Now, I want to point out the other thing that you hear, and I hear this even more frequently, is that it's government's fault. When Pity the Billionaire came out, Peter, I was on your radio show, but I was also on a lot of sort of AM talk shows around America, and I went on a book tour, and I would go to different towns, and you'd be on their drive time, you'd go into the studio and chat with the host, and I would be talking about the financial crisis, the meltdown, and the bailouts, which were my subject at the time, and without variation, somebody would call in and be blaming government for it, and it would always be a different story. Because they never really knew what exactly government had done, but they knew that government was forcing banks to give loans to poor people because in their world, in their sort of economic world, the world of their experience, banks would never do something this stupid on their own. So it had to be this outside actor coming in and forcing them to do it. Now, they could never actually tell you, what was the mechanism the government had used to make that happen, because there wasn't one. This didn't happen, but this is the myth. And everyone believes this. Not everyone. It's always people from a certain class. Mm-hmm. It tends to be small business people because in their experience, they themselves are very responsible with their money and they would never throw money around like that. And they can't imagine a banker, who's the sort of used to be in our culture anyway, a figure of great probity and uprightness.
Yeah.
They can't imagine bankers doing this. Nevertheless, that's what happened,
Well, and the most often spoken target is Fannie and Freddie, and most of these people have no idea what Fannie and Freddie did or do, and where the money comes from and what their standards were. And in fact, up until about 2007, I believe that Fannie and Freddie would not write loans to, refinance subprime deals.
That's right. They were very careful. I don't want to say they were very careful. They were more careful than the private sector lenders. They don't directly lend. They guarantee the loans. But up until they got into it very late in the game, and they got burned really badly because they owned they're exposed to the housing market by definition. That's all they have in their portfolio. So they went down hard. And there was a lot of bad behavior going on there, a lot of the same stuff with bonuses and things like that.
You mentioned McCain's threat for Senate hearings, but there was a commission set up that was chaired by my buddy Phil Angelides. Phil's a millionaire developer from Sacramento. He was the state treasurer. He was the sacrificial lamb who ran against Schwarzenegger a few years back. And he was given the job of conducting an investigation of the meltdown of 08. and he actually did a pretty decent job, but nobody paid any attention to his findings, and I believe that it didn't have any impact on Dodd-Frank. I think that was kind of a separate track, and they said, Phil, great report, thank you very much, now get lost.
That might be. You know, my wife worked on that commission as well. She
really?
Was one of the. Yeah, she was a staffer on that commission. So I probably should not. Don't want to express an opinion. I have to retain this sort of journalistic objectivity about the whole thing. So I don't want to. I don't want to go there. But look, my opinion is. Yeah. What do you think? I think they did a good job too.
Yeah. Phil is a fairly straight shooting kind of guy. Yeah. And he was given this task, and I think he focused on it and tried his best. So I'll let you off the hook there, due to your obvious conflict of interest. Next, I want to turn to some of the longer-term effects, because this produced on the right the Tea Party and nominally on the left Occupy, and these kind of discrete messages to the right that, bankruptcy was preferable to bailouts. And that's actually something that philosophically I have some sympathy for. I believe that AIG should have been permitted to go into bankruptcy and should not have been bailed out. And that was fundamental arguments that really led to what is now an AstroTurf monster, but the genesis of the Tea Party movement.
That's right.
And you've covered that in some detail.
That's right. Yes,
And you bought their T-shirts.
I bought their T-shirts. I went to a lot of Tea Party rallies. I have a lot of Tea Party memorabilia around this office. You can't see it from where the Skype camera is located, but somewhere around here. Hey, hold on.
We'll hold. We'll hold for Mr. Frank.
Yeah. Okay. So I picked this up at a Tea Party rally in Virginia.
don't believe
the liberal media. And they by that they mean just basically don't believe the media.
Yeah.
It's a call to retreat from the shared world. I found that really intriguing. But the first Tea Party, I went to the very first Tea Party rally. It was in D.C. It was about a month after Barack Obama was sworn in, and it was out in that park across the street from the White House, and it was clearly a setup. It was all of these people from the usual suspects, the various right-wing think tanks and lobby shops and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I recognized a bunch of guys. They recognized me, and here we all are. And everybody's got their sign, and they're wearing their, Revolutionary War memorabilia or their Revolutionary War costume, I mean. And I thought the whole thing was kind of silly. But I remember really clearly someone was holding a sign that said, "Let the failures fail." And that struck a nerve for me because even, I knew who these people were and I knew that it was AstroTurf and it was, a put on, But that was that really appealed to me. Let the failures fail. Now, I think that it should have been done very differently. I think you can have bailouts, but you can also put these companies out of their misery. And that should have happened. You can't just allow this kind of thing to go on and the go back to business as usual. It's not just impossible, but you remember the same people that were saying that. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting myself here, but the same people who were saying let the failures fail were also calling it nationalization when the government stepped in to liquidate the banks. So you can't have it both ways. If you want them to fail, they don't just go out of business. These are enormous, complicated enterprises that have to be unwound piece by piece through the process of liquidation, and they were objecting to that too. So, they weren't serious about it, but they captured the public anger, and they really captured the public anger. And they, of course, because they're so well organized and had all this money behind them and all of these, the think tanks in D.C., they were able to get off the ground very quickly, and they knew, this is our moment, let's get out there and do it. And I'll be damned if they didn't sweep the country. And we're still paying for this. I mean, they took over Congress. They took over state legislatures all over America. I was reading about North Carolina the other day. It's a state that used to be in play and now has swung far to the right. The same with Missouri. I'm from Kansas City. Missouri was always a battleground state. Now, all of a sudden, way to the right. This is true all over America. Now, yes, the Democrats won the election of 2012, and whoop-de-doo. But at the same time, the right managed to capitalize on a disaster that they themselves had caused with all of their, you know, deregulation. It's an amazing thing, amazing bit of jujitsu.
Have you finished interrupting yourself?
Yeah, I'm done now.
Okay, you had a couple of salient points in there.
Wait. One, I want to go back. Just kidding.
One about North Carolina. It's a battleground right now. And this guy, Art Pope, who writes checks and packed both houses of the legislature, has now been appointed budget director by the governor that he put into office. And the draconian moves that they're making there, not only on election rights, but abortion rights, tax cuts for the wealthy and shifts to the poor, rejecting Obamacare in the best interests of the Republican establishment. I really think there's a true crisis there, and the Democratic Party is flat-footed. They should be mobilizing and moving people in there to support the Moral Mondays, and there's no activity. They're also not confronting this coordinated effort to roll back abortion and contraception rights across the whole country.
Yes, and the same thing happened in Wisconsin. Remember that was one that really astonished me when the right took over Wisconsin, which is traditionally a fairly liberal state, mm-hmm. and got this guy Scott Walker in there and immediately started his war on the public sector unions. I just finished reading one of these campaign books. I mean, to answer your question, I just finished reading one of these campaign books about. I was reviewing it for Book Forum. It was a book by Jonathan Alter about Obama's reelection campaign. There's two books actually on the subject. And Alter was describing how the Obama people noticed what was going on in Wisconsin and Ohio, where you had right-wing governors swept in by the Tea Party wave who immediately declared war on public sector workers, you know, and on their pension plans and this kind of thing. And the Obama people saw their opportunity and went into Ohio, big battleground state, and used that anger to organize voters. And then Alter says several, you know, about 50 pages on. Oh, and by the way, Obama didn't really disagree with Scott Walker about the public sector workers and their pensions and everything. You know, he didn't have a big problem with that. He just wanted to organize the voters for his, you know, looking forward to his reelection campaign.
Well, Tom, let's just add to that litany, Michigan, which is now a right-to-work state, and the Republican leadership there lost a referendum in November that repealed the emergency manager law, so they just reenacted it in time to take over Detroit. Now, I think Detroit needs some really serious intervention, but to do it in an illegal and undemocratic way without a peep from the Democratic leadership in Washington, it's kind of breathtaking.
Yeah, you got to remember something about the Democratic leadership in Washington, and that is that they're focused on just one thing, which is the re-election of the president, and they did that. They won, you know, mission accomplished. This is always their problem, and it has been for a long time, ever since the Democratic Leadership Council. Do you remember these guys back in the 80s?
Terry McAuliffe.
Yeah, he was one of them, and and Bill Clinton was their leader at one point, but they're great. Scheme was to, you know, it was considered that the Democrats could never get another president elected. You know, look what had happened to Jimmy Carter. Look at Walter Mondale. You know, the Democrats were too liberal at the national level. But their focus and you know, Democratic Leadership Council was the beginning. This is now what they dreamed up is now common sense for the Democratic Party and for all of these groups in Washington. The only thing they care about is getting a Democratic president. They really aren't concerned about the rest of it.
And labor unions are just there to be milked during election season.
That's right. That's right. They never get – I mean, you know, they wanted one thing. They want, you know this. They wanted one thing, card check. And they and Barack Obama, who seemed to be – very much in favor of that when he was a U.S. senator, you know, wouldn't give them the time of day on that front.
Now, going back a couple of self-interruptions, you also made a point about nationalizing banks when they failed. And I recall that on the day that Chase was trading at $25 a share, the federal government injected over $100 billion there. And it was more than the market cap for Chase on that day. And yet we made no move even to install a conservator or a special master or some way of trying to force Chase to reform in exchange for the bailout money it was given.
not only that, we own shares in these companies. I think some of them we probably still do. I stopped following this, after Pity the Billionaire came out. But we owned shares in these companies. The government did, and yet the government, I believe, either never voted those shares or voted them only on very, very rare occasions.
Mm-hmm.
This was part of the bailout oversight. You know, this is in the 19. By the way, so when I was writing Pity the Billionaire, I did a lot of research on the history of bailouts, and you would be surprised to learn that there is a long history of bailouts in this country. It's not a novelty. You know, it's been going on. They did it a lot in the 30s, and there are. And this is the part that really. Where my eyes opened and I began to understand what was going on. There are different ways of doing bailouts. You can do them in the way that we did them now, where it's just a blank check and here's the money, which is also, by the way, what the Hoover administration did. Or you can do what Franklin Roosevelt did, which is you bail out the economy from the bottom up. And he and his team, they did bailouts in the Roosevelt years. By the way, bailouts were massively unpopular when Hoover did them because he was clearly bailing out the Wall Street banks, doing it through intermediaries sometimes. Always bailing out the Wall Street banks. Roosevelt didn't do that. Roosevelt and his team bailed out financial institutions from the bottom up. So like community banks, funny little credit unions and stuff like that, bailed them out. And the Wall Street people had to shift for themselves. Obviously, a lot of them went out of business. But what Roosevelt did was very popular, was massively popular. Those kind of bailouts can be very popular. But just throwing money at the Wall Street banks, just writing them a gigantic check, even if they do pay it back later on, that's politically toxic, not to mention stupid, economically stupid.
Tom, you wrote a very thoughtful essay. It was not for Harper's, and you can remind me where you published it, but it was about the Occupy movement. And
yeah.
You were sympathetic to their aims, but as a critical thinker, you looked at the impact and whatever results people might attribute to it and found it lacking. And I generally agreed with the analysis that you made there. Tell our listeners a little bit about your thoughts about Occupy.
Yeah, so when Occupy happened, it was a great moment for me. I mean, this is something I had wanted to see for years, and I was really angry, that stewing, because of the Tea Party movement had really sort of captured the anger of the public that rightfully belonged to the left. And so I was very happy to see a left-wing movement spring up, even though it was, 3 years late, and that sort of thing. It was 3 years almost to the day after Lehman Brothers that Occupy appeared. And Occupy didn't last long. They made a big splash in the media at first, and then the police finally threw them out of their park, and they had in the meantime generated no organization that might continue to carry the torch. And I think it was an opportunity missed is what I think it was. And why was the opportunity missed? There's two things. One is that they it was as part of their sort of organizing spirit was to never have demands. And they, they were very reluctant to ever focus on any one thing. And they fought back and forth about this constantly, and they debated this constantly. But the whole idea of Occupy was have this sort of open-ended debate and never really settle on anything. And that was an enormous missed opportunity, because if they had made demands, just a few, and, written some document, some well-crafted document, it would have been at every presidential debate. The candidates would have had to talk about it. It's like, well, the Occupy movement said this. What do you say to that? They would have been part of every, conversation about what to do about Wall Street. And so they didn't do that. It's an enormous missed opportunity. And then, they didn't have a structure, so there's, nothing left of them. They've got nothing to show for the fact they rallied millions of people. It was great. Everybody was enthusiastic about it, and we've got nothing to show for it now. And then the other thing is that it very quickly was sort of captured by this kind of academic left practice, this sort of academic version of the left. And that's partially because it was in New York City it had a lot of academic representation at the very beginning. And I, by the way, I have nothing against academics getting involved in left movements. I think they should, especially students. You know, I went to graduate school myself, and I used to, you know, read that the high-flown theory and that sort of thing. But you have to understand that that stuff has its place. It doesn't appeal to people. It doesn't rally people. It's a professional language that professionals use to communicate with one another. It's not the language that you use to build a political movement. You know, if you want to build a political movement, get out of New York City, you know, come to Kansas City and sign people up and tell us what we can do and how we can have an immediate impact. That's how you do it. You don't, put out a journal of theory, which they actually did, by the way. They spent a lot of their resources on that, resources on putting out a journal of theory. I never really understood why they would do that. It just didn't make any sense to me. But they did, you know.
Well,
it's all a terrible shame because I thought they really had it. They had a great slogan. They had some really dedicated people. They captured the public's imagination, and it's a shame.
I fully agree with you that a manifesto could have had much more impact. Despite the lack of the manifesto, there was a change in the national conversation that started to address wealth and income inequality, and that was valuable. There's no question about it. And as to their long-term sustainability, I will add that I've done a fair amount of coverage in the last year or so of the efforts to bust up Occupy. And there was a concerted program using the Homeland Security apparatus, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, and despite the widespread lack of violence among Occupy movements all across the country, they were nevertheless tagged as potential terrorists, anarchists, and that was used to justify all kinds of crackdowns that were largely left out of media coverage.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of reporters who have really dug into this and shown how those systems, the police state systems, were used to crack down on Occupy, and it ultimately did cause them to dissolve. But I think the recipe was there in the no leader, no movement effort, where it did dissipate under pressure from law enforcement.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's obviously the first thing that whenever you talk about what happened to it, obviously, you know, factor number one is the police came in and pushed them out of their park. But then it's just, you know, it's a shame that there is that we have nothing to show for it. A manifesto. People often underestimate the power of a manifesto and of well-crafted prose. And I think they had a real chance to put something like that up there that the country would have seen, and it would have had an impact. But you know, another sort of little tidbit from reading these books about Campaign 2012 is it did change the conversation, and it changed the conversation in a way that allowed Barack Obama to, you know, really nail Mitt Romney for being part of the 1%. I mean, the folly of the Republicans in nominating this, you know, essentially a man who is probably a billionaire, you know, as their candidate or something close to a billionaire in this environment. But that's really its only lasting impact right now, and that's I think that's tragic. I think that's a real shame.
Yeah. So Tom, as we wrap up here, what would you like to add? You a big fan of Larry Summers for Fed chairman in January? Isn't that the lesson of the last five years? Huh?
I can't believe that's even, you know, conceivable. I think Obama will choose Janet Yellen. I think that's what'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, who knows? I do want to say one thing, which is the paragraph that I conclude with in the Harper's article, which is that when we beheld this corruption, and corruption is the right word for it, it was that it was very clear when we watched these events take place in 2008, and we watched like the AIG bonus chapter unfold. That was in March of the next year, of 2009. The public was furious, and we watched this unfold, and we knew that our government was the defender and the protector of crooks. We could all see this. And we now, I think, you know, now we're 5 years on, essentially nothing has happened. I mean, little things have happened, but In the big picture, nothing has happened. And what's the grand effect of that, Peter? I think it's that it has corrupted us as well. I remember a long time ago, after the Soviet Union fell, You remember how Eastern Europe used to be swept by these pyramid schemes? Do you remember that? Countries like Albania, constantly having these, you know, pyramid schemes one after the other. And everybody knew that they were pyramid schemes. Everybody knew it was a Ponzi scheme. They just said, you know, I'm going to get out early before it all falls apart. I know what it is, and I know it's going to fall apart. And I think that's what's happened to us, that it has – seeing this happen and seeing nothing happen to the perps, seeing them get away with it has corrupted us as a people. And so we look at, you know, at this, and all we say now is, what's the next bubble? You know, I want to get in early on this one, you know? Now, I'm going to get out before it collapses.
On the Skype cam, and my listeners can't see this, but there's four large gold bricks on the shelf right behind you. So are you moving to gold? And
Come on. Yeah, I've made a career out of mocking gold bugs. It's one of my things, you know?
Well, Tom, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I have the answer to the question that you didn't answer, which is it was The Baffler where you published your piece.
That's right, yeah. I'm sorry. That's a magazine that I started 25 years ago, Peter. 25 years ago when I was at the University of Virginia. Mm-hmm. I had just graduated, and I thought my friends and I said, let's start us a literary magazine. And it's still going – I'm not in charge anymore, but it's still going strong to this day. In fact, I think it's better than ever nowadays. It's just looking really good. And I have a good essay in the upcoming issue. I hope you'll interview me about that. We also have one from Susan Faludi about Sheryl Sandberg. It's really, really good. You'll see it.
I will go online and catch up on The Baffler. I've been lapsed.
All right, then. You do that, Peter B. You catch up.
Thomas Frank is the Easy Chair columnist for Harper's Magazine and has written many great books and indulges me occasionally with these rambling conversations. Enjoyed it, Tom. Thank you very much.
Sure thing, Peter.
Next on the Peter B. Collins Show, we take a look at fracking in California. Bring it up to small town, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drill is making killing. Water goes into the pipe into the ground. The pressure cranks, pushes 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town. That will frack, yeah, totally frack. But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow. With names like benzene and formaldehyde, you better keep a pull away from the water supply. The drillers say the fishes are a mile below. The groundwater pumped into American homes. But don't tell it to the residents of Cerro Guayo. That water's frack. This music is the soundtrack to a powerful video that you can find on YouTube. Just do a search for anti-fracking song. It's called The Fracking Song, My Water's on Fire Tonight. It never comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight. Ken Jones is an activist here in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's involved with the Progressive Democrats of America, 350 Marin. That's an offshoot of the National 350 group started by Bill McKibben. He is a Democratic delegate to the state convention and a retired therapist. Ken Jones, welcome to our program today.
Thank you, Peter.
Why do you care about fracking?
Well, fracking is clearly associated with climate disruption, and it really gets down to we must leave the shale oil in the ground. It is very low quality, high sulfur, heavy crude oil here in California. A lot of people across the country are more familiar with fracking related to natural gas. But in California, it is pretty exclusively related to getting shale oil out of the ground. Mm-hmm. And the damage it will cause to the environment in many of the ways we're all familiar with through water, excess use of water, the damage to the environment through wastewater leaking into the aquifers are certainly big problems. The climate change thing is what we focus on in 350 Marin and 350 Bay Area, and the arguments for that should play very well in California because of the passage of AB 32, which is the climate change bill in 2006 that Governor Schwarzenegger mm-hmm. got through.
Right.
And so I'm trying to make arguments for people and educate people about that issue pretty exclusively.
And for me, Ken, from beginning to end, hydraulic fracturing is a reckless and dangerous process. And it is driven by the desire to get old oil wells to cough up the remainder, the stuff that didn't easily flow to the surface. That has emboldened the extraction industries to tap into new sources and to now start to exploit shale for both oil and for natural gas. And you start off with the damage to the local environment by the tapping of groundwater, because it takes massive amounts of water to frack. Then you add a cocktail of toxic chemicals, which the industry claims is covered by trade secrets, but we know it includes benzene and many other extremely toxic elements. We don't know the proportions that are used, and the industry is largely protected by regulations that were put in by Dick Cheney back in the Bush-Cheney administration. Then we talk about the damage to underground structures, the earthquakes that have popped up in my birth state of Ohio. There were never any earthquakes there throughout my entire residency there, and the northeast portion of the state where the extraction and fracking are occurring have been the site of earthquakes. Also, Texas has seen some earthquakes caused by fracking. Then we have the issues of the methane that escapes when the oil or gas is being pumped out, and we know that unless they are extremely vigilant, that is a source of greenhouse gas emissions that really negates the alleged benefits of extracting gas in particular, which is seen as less toxic than coal for the production of electricity. So, as I said, from end to end, it's a very dangerous and reckless process that really seems to be driven by Armageddon mindsets. It's like, hey, who cares if we destroy the planet?
Yes, Peter, you're very well educated on this, I can see. One of the issues that you hear so much from the oil industry is we've been doing fracking for 60 years here in California, which might possibly be true, but it is nothing like the fracking that they are planning to do and may have already started to do, as probably many of you are well aware of, you know, outside. You know, since 2007, they do horizontal fracking, and they can get to things that they couldn't get to in the past, and that's where the Monterey Shale deposits come into play.
Mm-hmm.
There is 15 billion barrels of dirty oil from the Monterey Shale that could conceivably release up to 6.45 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide.
Help our listeners understand the geography. The Monterey Shale is in central California from the coast to the San Joaquin Valley. And in order to tap it, we are putting at risk the breadbasket of America, the Central Valley where so much of our vegetables and other crops come from.
Yeah, right. Recently, there was an almond farmer, Tom Franst, who managed to catch on a telephone video and then posted it on YouTube of one of the oil companies associated with Occidental Petroleum dumping their wastewater into an unlined pit in Shafter, California. It was written about in New York Times. And the Central Valley Water Board, which is supposed to be watching over this, of course, they only have two on-ground inspectors for, 40% of the state and almost exclusive to the areas where they do oil wells. They kind of panicked and said, yeah, this looks pretty bad. And finally, so far, I think the oil company has been fined $750 for that. So
there's an outfit in Pennsylvania that was caught taking the wastewater that comes post-fracking, okay, that water's got to go somewhere. They put it in tanker trucks, and in the middle of the night, they drove through towns and just drained the tanks into storm sewers.
Yeah.
So the way the industry has operated has also invited a crackdown on their methods, and they still remain free of most local and state regulation because of the policies that were invoked back when Cheney was running the show. In California, fracking has been documented in 10 counties. Colusa, Glenn, Kern, which is one of the biggest production areas, that's Bakersfield, Los Angeles County, Monterey, Sacramento, Santa Barbara, that's where some of the offshore action is taking place, Sutter County, which is in the Gold Country, Kings, and Ventura, Ventura also a coastal county. So that is where things stand right now. But with the aspiration to exploit the Monterey Shale, we're talking about massive expansion, potentially, of fracking in California if the industries have their way.
Yeah, that's the concern right now, is that it's going to take off in California. And what people, even in California, don't know is that it is even broader than the areas you were just talking about, Peter. Butte County, up in Chico area, they're very concerned because there is oil drilling up there as well, and they're doing some fracking. Even here in the Bay Area, it comes up into the Salinas area. And so it's not as removed from the areas that people who seem to get the most concerned about it. People in the Bay Area often are a little more concerned than some of the areas that it happens in Central Valley, because they think there are jobs created from this process.
Now, Ken, have you been able to determine, because you've been testifying in Sacramento, you've been lobbying elected officials, we're going to talk about some of the legislation that is pending coming up here shortly, but do you believe that California is paying attention to the stark lessons that people are paying the price for in Pennsylvania and New York State, where fracking has really expanded dramatically? And the state governments, in the case of Pennsylvania, they're just boosters of the industry, saying, you know, frack some more, frack under the state capitol, we don't care. In New York, it's a little dicier. Governor Cuomo has, you know, it's really hard to read him. But it seems that he does recognize the political price he will pay if he's seen as a full-throated supporter of fracking. But do our political leaders, are they paying attention to what has already happened in the East?
Well, I'm afraid our legislatures tend to notice the lobbyists for the oil industry as they walk through the hallways with money falling out of their pockets, more than they're noticing what's going on in New York and some of the other places that have put bans on fracking, actually, or moratoriums. And that is part of the difficulty. We're trying to educate a lot of the legislators and making some headway. The movement Californians Against Fracking is fairly new. It's a group of over 200 now organizations, environmental organizations. And the pro side on a new bill, SB4, the only one that made it through the legislature here.
There were four bills originally over the course of the last 6 months.
Actually, there was 10.
And
three of them were clear moratorium bills, and maybe seven others were what might be called regulation bills on some aspect of fracking. The three moratorium bills, one of them went forward and was supposed to be combined with the other two, but the best one, AB 1301, the author saw what was about to happen to the moratorium bill in the legislature that Holly Mitchell put forward, AB 1323, and held his back in suspense, which allows it to be brought forward in the next session. And what happened to AB 1323 is a travesty, basically. It's not clear who, but it looks very much like leadership, probably Speaker Perez, gutted it in kind of the middle of the night, just before it was brought to the floor for a vote. So it had the name, and we got a vote, and it was voted down, but there were 21 abstentions in the vote, probably from some legislators who thought, well, what is this bill now? And so we've got a good bill still waiting out there. And
that's SB4, Senate Bill 4.
Well, SB4 is not particularly a good bill. It is considered more, even the author calls it a notification and transparency bill. So when I talk about it, I say it basically allows us to learn from the oil company what they are doing, how they're doing it to some degree, though there are still some trade secrets left in terms of the chemical concoction that they're using. It has been broadened somewhat to include all well stimulation techniques at this moment, but it is in the Appropriations Committee where things go to get changed pretty drastically.
Mm-hmm. And let me just restate, I didn't mean to suggest that SB 4 is a great bill. It's the survivor of this process. But you were starting to tell us about a good bill, and I didn't want to interrupt you about that. What was the good bill, and where is it?
The good bill is the AB 1301. It's Harold Bloom's bill from Santa Monica, and basically it is one that says we need to stop this process now because it's clearly something that looks pretty bad, especially at the level that we're going to be fracked at coming up here for the Monterey Shale. So let's take a time out and look at this in detail before we go forward with it. And we lobbied for it very strongly in May, and we really saw the writing on the wall. But the movement wasn't quite as solid as it is even now. And election year is coming up next year, 2014, even for the governor. And the governor, of course, likes to call himself a climate change governor. And if there was anything one could say about fracking in California, it will destroy our chances to reach the greenhouse gas emissions that were set by AB 32, which is we're supposed to get back to the 1990 levels. And you're not going to do that with fracking for this oil in California.
And Jerry Brown has been generally absent from this debate, has he not?
Yeah, he made a comment in a news broadcast or where he had a lot of news people asking questions, and they asked his stand on fracking in California. And he made the comment, well, you know I'm a climate change governor. I really care a lot about the climate. And then he paused for a second. But this looks like a great opportunity. So, you know, I'm not sure where he stands, but it looks like he's seen some money falling out of pockets as well.
Well, he does appear to be planning to run for a fourth term, the second in his current cycle next year. And it takes a lot of money to do that. He has no idea if there's a new Meg Whitman out there ready to run against him. So first and foremost, Governor Moonbeam is a politician and a very calculating one at that. And I'm sure he, in that shaved head of his, has run the numbers quite thoroughly.
Yes, I think, though, that he's getting calls. We're doing something like what they did in New York to get Cuomo to declare a moratorium. There's what's called No Fracking Way Mondays, and that's when everybody is reminded to call the governor and let him know that we do not want fracking here. We want a moratorium right now. And legislators are being talked to all across the state regarding this SB 4 bill, that it's not enough. And they're feeling it. So there's potential for this to be the election issue in 2014.
Now, Ken Jones, you have a button that says call Jerry and tell him no fracking. Let's give out the number here. It's 916-445, and I got a 2841.
Right.
So again, 916-445-2841. That is the governor's office in the state of California. And you don't have to be a California resident to call Jerry Brown and let him know how you feel.
No.
So wherever you're listening, if you want to use up some of your free minutes on that fancy cell phone you're packing, call Sacramento and let Jerry Brown know how you feel about fracking. So let's go into a little more detail here about the big picture nationally, Ken. Because it is important what California and the states do, but we have a big picture where the Obama administration is promoting this all-of-the-above policy. And I think it's a huge cop-out, and it's incoherent, you know, just in any objective, rational review of where we stand, the clear nature. I mean, the UN climate change panel is back at it again. We're now 95% certainty, and yet it is still treated as if this is a debatable matter, and that we've got all the time in eons to deal with this. And so the Obama administration has not set an appropriate tone. This new energy secretary from MIT, Muniz, is a pro-fracking, pro-nuke, pro-coal kind of guy. And so with the exception of Gina McCarthy, promoted at the Environmental Protection Agency, is there an advocate inside this administration who has the president's ear about these matters?
I'm not too sure there is, and I'm a little concerned that Obama does listen to the people around him, but the people he picks around him to tell him things are not exactly the people we'd like to see. So his comments at the climate change, when he did a good job of setting the stage where it was so hot people could barely stand sitting there listening to him, and he was wiping his brow and with the sweat off as he talked, but what he said basically was, in a segment anyway, was that fracking is definitely a great thing, and we need to do more of it. And people in the anti-fracking movement were just devastated when they heard that part of it.
He's also waffling on the Keystone XL pipeline issue, which it, to me, is more iconic than significant, you know, in the broadest sense. But he has, at different times, articulated the clear reasons why the Keystone XL pipeline is not needed and should not be approved. In particular, he recently punctured the allegations, which are phony, that it'll create a lot of jobs. And he flatly said what critics have said, that there are a couple of thousand jobs that'll be created during construction, and then it's just a handful of employment opportunities after that. And the promoters of the Keystone XL pipeline, it's like they sat there with an old adding machine and just kept hitting the multiply button, because to reach the claims that they offer about job creation, you have to include taxi drivers, bartenders, hookers, exotic dancers, and a lot of people who get money that trickles out of the pockets of people who might work on the pipeline itself.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that oil industry says all the time about this is the jobs, because it seems to play so well with Obama, perhaps. But it's so clear that those are so inflated. It's just mind-boggling. I mean, I think they said in California that it would create, I have it here somewhere, 2.8 new jobs.
2.8?
2.8 million, excuse
me. Oh, come on.
And
who are they kidding?
Even if I do a very close calculation with the Bakken Shale jobs in North Dakota and stretch that quite a ways, the whole life cycle of drilling for this Monterey Shale oil might create maybe 120,000 jobs. And let's see, last year we had an increase of 49,000 solar energy jobs in California alone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nothing, really, compared to what we could be getting if we went in the direction of renewable. And that's part of the difficulty with Obama is if he was listening to the renewable energy people, there's things like we have, three or four energy grids in the United States that are separated from each other. And one of the problems with renewable energy is getting it to where we need to get it to. If we tied those energy grids together, which somebody estimated would cost about $60 billion, we could really get renewable energy anywhere we want it. Wind and solar would go wherever it's needed at whatever time it's needed. And $60 billion, I think that was close to the figure that we're spending on Hurricane Sandy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was.
Yeah, that's right.
So it really, if we didn't subsidize oil for what they're doing to us so they could make their profits, we could easily subsidize solar and wind and our energy grid to a degree where we could be more like Germany, you know?
Well, the other phony argument that's offered is this notion of energy independence, and it's used with, you know, kind of subliminal racism that we're currently getting our oil from Arabs, and we can't trust those Arabs, and therefore we need to pollute the planet and risk destroying it in order to achieve some notion of independence. But we know that the Keystone, if it's built, will pump sludge, this ugly shale, from Canada to Texas, where it'll be refined in American airspace and then shipped overseas. So it'll make no impact on so-called independence. The other point that I think is worth noting, and I learned this from the ballot measure campaign a few years ago where we failed to pass a wellhead tax on oil extraction, but California currently produces somewhere around 44% of the oil that is converted to gasoline and consumed in this state. And that surprises a lot of people because we're seen as a net importer of oil. And so I think that's a something that will surprise particularly listeners in other parts of the country who don't think of California as an oil producer. But we're already doing our part, I believe. And to add fracking and the extraction of this you know, very toxic sludge, the heavy crude of tar sands, I just think is embarking in the wrong direction. And we should be promoting Tesla and other alternatives as opposed to doubling down on the old technologies.
Yeah, we have a decent law here, that AB 32 I mentioned before, the cap and trade bill, which is cited as a model. Certainly could be a little better. There are ways to game that, but certainly a carbon tax would have been better. But this oil, you know, that as dirty as it is, they attempted to refine it in the Chevron refinery in Richmond. It's essentially slightly dirtier than tar sands oil, and they tried some tar sands oil in the Richmond refinery. And it was so sulfur intensive that that was cited as the reason why, partly because they didn't do what they were supposed to with their pipe fittings that OSHA and some of the regulators were telling to do for years, but that caused the Richmond refinery fire.
About last August,
yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So there's the question of whether this oil that they're going to bring out of the Monterey Shale really could be used here. Because we have some higher standards for what we put in our tanks than some other states across the country. So here we are going to bring out this oil, and we get to have all their cost externalized to us for all of the problems it's going to cause in this state. And perhaps they're going to go sell it to the place where they can get the best prices in China.
Mm-hmm. And Ken, just a footnote, you and other activists participated in a protest at Chevron in Richmond, California on August 6th. Is that the anniversary of the fire?
It was right around then.
Uh-huh. And you were arrested.
Yeah, it was one of 210, actually, that were arrested that day. And that made a statement. Some people across the country, and I'm sure Chevron and Richmond noticed that. They're struggling with their sighting of themselves in Richmond. The community in Richmond has been really hit hard by an awful lot of what the refinery puts out there. So we were there partly in support of Richmond, but also to make a statement about the whole problem with climate change and oil and all of that. So,
Now, Ken, let's turn briefly to your lobbying on the local level, because I do see that on a lot of these issues, whether it's trying to amend the Constitution to fix the Citizens United court decision or other actions, that support can bubble up from the local level and really lead to significant change. So you recently got a resolution passed just this week at the Marin County Board of Supervisors calling for a moratorium on fracking in the entire state. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, R.L. Miller, who is a well-known activist here in California, blogs on Daily Coast a lot, and was elected in this last convention as the chair of the Environmental Caucus, she mentioned that this passage of the resolution was, this is big, she said. I think it is the first in California to be passed, and it's such a clear statement. It's quite an educational piece, and it's a little different than the resolution passed at the Democratic convention in April, which only had two or three whereases, I believe. This one has 12 and gets very deeply into the issue of climate change and its effect, fracking's effect on that. And it was a 5-0 vote. And that was impressive, I think, for our county to make that statement. We're not going to have any fracking probably right here. So it's maybe a little easier for us to get something like that passed, but it is a model resolution for the state and other communities to follow, and already many of them have asked for copies. So this could move forward more rapidly, and the timing of it was quite good, too, because we were working with the supervisors on getting it done before the vote comes up on this SB4, and they did it, so we're impressed.
Well, Ken, if you'll email me a copy of it, I'll put up a link to it in the show file with this podcast, so people who listen all over the country can access this resolution and maybe get it passed at their local government body. The other issue relates to our new assembly member, Mark Levine. And let me be honest with our listeners, he was elected in a very contentious race last year in November, and I worked for his opponent, Michael Allen. So I have a clear bias, and I want that to be out in the open. But Mark Levine carried a bill that didn't survive, and talk a little bit about what the terms of his proposal were related to fracking.
Yes, the bill that Mark Levine proposed, it was one of the seven that I talked about before that was not moratorium bills, but it basically was dealing with water, and it was considered one of the better of the seven regulation bills, but it was working with Dogger, which is the agency that's been under fire here in California for doing so little. Essentially, the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources has been investigated by the Environmental Protection Agency on an independent study and found extremely wanting. They don't even know which oil wells are being fracked in California at this point. And so this bill basically was telling that Dogger needed to pay a little more attention to certain things. Mm-hmm. But that's not likely to happen, even if the bill passed. But in any case, it didn't pass. It was one of the ones that was gutted in the wee hours of the morning before it went to the floor. And, of course, it didn't pass either with lots of abstentions.
And where is Levine on what remains of SB4, the Pavley bill, which, as you described earlier, isn't the greatest, but it would provide for some disclosures about the toxic chemicals being used and a few other regulations?
Well, he's tried to tell everybody, and I'm a believer that he would vote for a moratorium bill, I think, if it comes up again. But he definitely is trying to have it both ways right now. He's painting himself as strongly pro-moratorium and penned an editorial in a local paper with the supervisor that put forth the resolution. But he is for SB4, the regulation bill, which, if it passes, will make it quite a bit more difficult to get a moratorium bill passed because legislators, of course, will say, well, you know,
we fixed it.
We fixed it. Been there, done that. We don't maybe need to look at that for a few years. Of course, that would give the oil companies long enough to get a lot of the oil out. Mm-hmm. So
then you align with the Sierra Club, which is alone at this point among environmental groups in continuing to oppose SB4.
Well, it looks that way. Sierra Club was a kind of a late addition in California here, actually, but one that we appreciate greatly to the opposition to the bill. There is the group I mentioned before, Californians Against Fracking, that includes Food and Water Watch, Center for Biological Diversity, and a host of others, 350 Bay Area, and familiar groups that you're aware of, Greenpeace, Rainforest Action Network, a whole slew of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that press release will come out in just a couple of days with just who they are and how they stand on regulation versus moratorium. So it's quite a strong alliance in California here.
Ken, finally, I told you before we started recording that one of my key sources on fracking and climate change is Steve Horn at DSmogBlog. Share with us some of the resources that you think our listeners might want to access to become better informed about fracking and about the grassroots movements to stop it.
Well, I would say that Food and Water Watch has some very good information on their site. And surprisingly, I've used, to get information, I've used Clean Water Action, even though they are one of the few, maybe five or six groups that are kind of supporting us before. It's an excellent website for getting information, particularly on California issues. Our 350 Bay Area group is also quite good. We have our fact sheet on SB4, but it's a new group, and we're still getting our website more detailed with information on this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Ken, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for your activism, and I hope you won't stop.
Thank you, Peter. This was a nice chance to educate Californians and people across the country about what's happening here.
Thanks for listening to the latest from PeterBCollins.com. Your comments are always welcome. Hit me, Peter, at PeterBCollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.